How influential do you think Tom Paine was in all this debate?
Ah, Paine. Paine claimed he was independently responsible for independence, more than the king, I guess. And, you know, there's a certain superficial case to be made for that. That is, the colonists weren't publicly speaking much about independence before January 1776, when Common Sense was published. Then suddenly you got a public debate over this as a possibility. But it coincides with the arrival of some very destructive news. First of all, the colonists are coming to know, they learn about the king's speech in October 1775, where basically he dismissed the colonists' claims that they wanted reconciliation. Later by February, they're going to learn about the Prohibitory Act, which again puts the colonies outside the king's protection. The Congress itself is started to think maybe they're not going to say we don't want independence so much, independent of Common Sense. The Congress understood the situation was becoming desperate. What Common Sense did was to begin that debate in the outside the Congress, I think among the members of the great public. It was a no-no issue before. You didn't talk about it. It became publicly debated, and that was terribly important because of the way these revolutionary institutions were structured. They depended on grants of power from the people because the whole situation was extra-legal and elective. That is, the provincial assemblies were dependent on votes from the localities, counties, or towns. And often, as localities elected delegates, they gave them instructions. This is what you should do, what we think you should do. Sometimes we won't confine you. You'll get information we don't have, and we trust your judgment. But this is what we think you should do. And if you don't do it, you know, you're going to go home and have to explain. So you needed to have the people behind you. The debates in Congress were very clear on this. Those who said, yes, independence, but not now. That is, the opponents of it in June 1776 said, we can't go forward until the people are behind us. The people are changing rapidly, but they're not there yet. That's what Common Sense did. It helped to move the public to where the Congress was, I think, already going. But what's very interesting is that when you look at these local statements on independence, you occasionally find little evidence of Paine's influence. They use a phrase, 'tis time to part, you know. But they don't ever use Paine's argument for independence. Paine's argument was our liberties will never be secure under the British system because the system is flawed. Hereditary lords and a hereditary king is just incompatible with liberty. The only British institution which is compatible with freedom is the House of Commons, basically, which is elected. And the problem with the English House of Commons, it has been corrupted by the monarchy, bought out, basically. So you have to start all over, redesign your institutions, place all authority in the people. The problem with Britain was not George III. The problem with Britain was the British institution of monarchy. And it's systemic. It isn't personal. It's systemic. Well, hey, the Declaration of Independence pins it on the king, partly because that was the English form, but it's also personal. It isn't systemic. And the locals also talk of a train of policy. They say they're forced into it. They don't say we can no longer be governed under the institutions of Britain because they're flawed. They use Paine's language. Occasionally, they never use his argument. So I think that those local statements give us some measure of Paine's actual influence and its limits.
Now, Jefferson and John Adams were both the prime movers in this revolutionary period, and then they later become commentators on the revolutionary period in their letters that they write.
Yes, yes.
How would you describe the characters of these two men and sort of their different views on the meaning of the past, I guess?
The statements that Adams and Jefferson made in the late 1810s and the 1820s on the drafting of the Declaration have shaped all subsequent scholarship. And the reason's quite clear. We don't have any earlier accounts. We have a few documents from the time, but nobody bothered to ask about the drafting of the document till it was almost 50 years old. And this has to do with a real sea change in American attitudes toward their history. It's really only after the War of 1812 is over that a generation comes into its own which says this is a tradition we have to preserve, we have to save the documentary heritage, the documents are being lost. Oh, we have to go interview these old guys before they die, or they're going to take all kinds of knowledge with them which will be unrecoverable. And this is the context in which we get these interviews. But they raise all kinds of questions about whether we can believe old men, I think, because what they say is shaped by everything which had happened in between and by their personal situation at the time. Of course, Jefferson and Adams had belonged to different parties. In the late 1790s, they had been rivals. Jefferson, having been Adams's vice president, became his rival for the presidency in the election of 1800, and there was a great division in their friendship at that point. That was only healed around 1812 when they began writing to each other again. But Adams remained annoyed. They just said that Jefferson ran off with all the glory that was deserved by many, not by one person, and that to give such emphasis to the Declaration of Independence itself was to give emphasis to dressing or to superficial dressing or the presentation of a decision rather than to the decision itself. It was celebrating the dress, not the woman, if you will. And the woman that he wanted to celebrate was independence itself. And, of course, he himself was the most active advocate of independence in the Congress, and he certainly felt that he was being underappreciated. But he also didn't like the forms of adoration, quasi-religious, which the country was taking up by the 1820s. So his view was very shaped by this. He gave an account of the drafting where he claimed that the committee appointed to draft the Declaration of Independence had appointed both he and Thomas Jefferson to prepare the text. That was probably wrong. He got it wrong. He said it differently earlier on. He was sort of trying to crawl into the seat of honor, I think, with Jefferson. I'm not sure he understood what he was doing. I am inclined to think these memories are honestly held at the time. We come to believe our own stories after we tell them enough, you know? And then Jefferson, of course, said Adams has it wrong. And people's memories are very flawed. Jefferson was conscious of this. He says Thomas McKean of Pennsylvania had told stories wrong. Adams had it wrong. He's not surprising. He says it's a long time ago. But you can believe me, he said. You can believe me because I have the documents. I have notes I took in my seat in Congress at the time. And he also had the original rough draft, which is now in the possession of the Library of Congress, is an occasionally put on display at the Library of Congress. I think he failed to understand, of course, what he didn't know what these documents were. Interpretation of documents is, of course, a big part of the historical profession. They're not so clear, so immediately understandable as he was suggesting. As it was, he had some notes, but he'd probably copied them over well after the fact. They weren't the notes as he took while he was sitting there. And in any case, he had mistakes in them. We know he had mistakes in them. And he said that he had drafted the entire document except for a few changes that Adams and Franklin had made. And you could see them on the original rough draft in their handwritings. And all the other changes he noted were in his handwriting. So I should explain what the original rough draft is. It's the text as Jefferson prepared it from earlier fragments for presentation to other members of the drafting committee. On that same piece of paper, he wrote in every subsequent change. It does include changes in the handwriting of Franklin and Adams, but every subsequent change made in committee, and then later those that were made by Congress, between July 2nd and 4th. Well, he saw all these changes in his handwriting, assumed he made them. It was a mistake, but I think it was an honest mistake. Almost 50 years later, he had the document. He said, "See, it's in my handwriting. I did it." What he forgot was this letter I found from June 1776, where basically he's writing to Benjamin Franklin, and he said, the committee just met, and it asked me to make some changes in the document, and I've written them in, and I hope you can look at this and see if you want any other changes and send them back, because I have to show it to the committee in the morning. 50 years later, he said, the only changes were made by Adams and Franklin. Everything else was mine. The committee looked at it and says, beautiful, just send it on as it is. Made no further changes. But the letter of the time said not only that Congress had mandated certain changes, but that he had made them, which is why they were in his handwriting.
Do you think that the changes that Congress made to the document were substantive or just purely cosmetic?
Oh, I think they were both, is the answer. There's one place where he says he's neglected utterly. He said utterly neglected. They changed the adverb and the verb around so that it really sounded much better. And that sort of charms me because it shows the Congress's attention to detail. They hacked off, well, we all remember the phrase, the long passage that was laboriously drafted by Jefferson, blaming the king for carrying on the slave trade. We remember this often incorrectly as an attack on slavery, which it was not. It was an overwritten passage, on the face of it, untenable. It was as if George III personally got in every ship, went to Africa, herded the slaves onto the ship, sailed across the Atlantic. I mean, he was personally responsible for the whole slave trade. It just wasn't true. The Americans were deeply involved in this, and there was certainly something disingenuous about the passage. So they hacked it off, both for literary and for substantive reasons. They cut back dramatically the attack on the British people, which is the second to last section of the document, and it was overwritten. It was too long. If you look in the appendix of my book, where I have the draft as it was submitted by the committee to Congress, as best we can reconstruct it, with all of the editings marked off. It's very interesting. The editings are more toward the end of the document. My guess is that, you know, Jefferson wrote the beginning, and he began writing, you know, as I do the day, go over what I wrote the day before, so that by the time you're done, the beginning is in pretty good shape, but the end's a mess. The end needed a severe editing, and Congress gave it that editing. They also changed, you know, phrases in between to make them more accurate. They didn't accuse the king, for example, of interfering with the rights of the colonies by not asking for permission for having ships of war, because it wasn't clear what the colonial legislatures, what rights did they have over the seas, where he says the king has imposed unremitting injuries. This is the Jefferson draft. You know, the king never slept. He was just throwing out one thunderbolt after another, one unremitting injury after another. They change it to repeated, which is much more accurate. One point after another, they made it more accurate. My students say it's because they were lawyers in the Congress. You know, they wouldn't take this overstatement. Whatever, it's a more believable, temperate document than it was before the Congress got it. I think most modern scholars look at those changes and have no doubt that Congress improved the document measurably, to make it even stronger.
Has the Declaration of Independence always had the reputation that it has today? Was it immediately famous?
It was forgotten at first. I mean, a press announcement, once the announcement's been made, is what good is it? You know, it's not too useful. And it was not particularly regarded at all. Even on the 4th of July celebrations, when they were held in the 1780s, the Declaration wasn't read. At any rate, I have found no evidence of subsequent public readings of it. Where the document was cited, the citations are always to the final paragraph. That is the paragraph that says that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. It's because independence was what was new. Independence was, the New York Times said once in reviewing this book, the big deal in 1776. Interestingly, that line was not Jefferson's. It was written by his kinsman, Richard Henry Lee, and it was the resolution that he brought into Congress, which was finally adopted on June 2nd, 1776. Congress had substituted that in the final paragraph for the text proposed by Jefferson and the drafting committee. Alas, the Jefferson Memorial Commission didn't know that and put the final paragraph, or a condensation of it, on the Jefferson Memorial. That is, they put a passage Jefferson didn't write. But that was the most influential passage at the time because of the significance of independence. I've found no references whatsoever to the second paragraph, which is, of course, what we remember. Why did they come into prominence later? When? It starts in the 1790s with the Jeffersonian Republicans, and, of course, it gains great breadth after the War of 1812. But I think it's because they were not stated in the Declaration, they were not stated in the Constitution. And even when we got what we call the Bill of Rights, that is the first 10 amendments, there was no statement of those basic revolutionary principles of men's original equality, of their possession of inalienable rights or natural rights, no statement that governments are designed to protect those rights, certainly no statement that if government failed to do that, they could be reformed or, rejected and replaced. Those were the principles of the revolution. They're often stated in state bills of rights, but there's no inkling of them in either the Constitution or the as originally passed or the first 10 amendments. Interestingly, James Madison, who proposed what we call the Bill of Rights on June 8, 1789, wanted a prefix or a preamble added to the Constitution, which would have included a watered-down version of those principles as stated in, say, the Virginia Declaration of Rights or, of another generation, the Declaration of Independence. That's the only part he referred to as the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Rights, and Congress axed it. Okay, you don't have those principles stated. They're deeply held, widely shared, and obviously very important. It seems to me significant that the Declaration of Independence is rescued from the trash bin of history in the 1790s when it begins its transformation from a revolutionary manifesto into a surrogate Bill of Rights. And I think most Americans feel that their basic rights are stated more eloquently in the Declaration of Independence than they are in the Bill of Rights, and they're quite correct. That they weren't in the other documents meant this document had to be resurrected. And it was then reinterpreted in the fights in the street over, what equality, what does that mean for me as a woman? What does it mean for someone else as an African-American? What does it mean for gays? Look, we fought that off with opposition. The meaning has been expanded. The document itself has become significant in ways and in entirely different ways than the persons who first drafted and signed it understood it.
You mentioned that in the Jefferson Memorial in the title basin there were some inaccuracies. What do you think of this as a memorial, and what is it actually memorializing?
Well, it's obviously the Jefferson Memorial was created in the 1930s, and some people see this as a terrific Rooseveltian trick to capture the Jeffersonian heritage, which was basically one for small government, for the greatest movement in politics to resurrect the presence of the federal government in the lives of most Americans. I don't know, possibly. It is, look, I remember when I first visited the Jefferson Memorial, finding those passages extremely moving. The one great contribution Jefferson did make, I think, to this country is that he stated so eloquently many of the principles which we like to think characterize us as a people. He had difficulty living according to those principles. We tend to forget that. I think it makes him more interesting. In some ways,
how specifically did he have difficulty?
Well, of course, I think particularly of his presidency. People could also cite his problems with slavery. I mean, here's a man who said all men are created equal, which meant in the beginning that no one is born subject to another, imposed by nature or by God, that all legitimate authority is by consent. The Declaration says that's a perfectly fine English Revolutionary doctrine. But what does that have to do with slaves? slaves are born into their status. Consent has nothing to do with it. So it's a tremendous violation of the principle stated. And indeed, Jefferson acknowledged that in the paragraph, it was sort of the subtext to the paragraph on the slave trade that the Continental Congress took out of his draft declaration. He accuses the king of interfering with the rights of these slaves as men. So he acknowledges they're men. If they're men, they have everything that the second paragraph said. And if the king is violating it with the slave trade, what was Jefferson doing it with the slaves at Monticello? Well, you know, they were all violating their principles. The question was how you could get to consistency, and that is a problem that, you know, people confronted in different ways. The North ended their slave systems. There was a wave of some voluntary manumissions in the South. In any case, this is a place where clearly principle and practice in Jefferson's life and that of several other people were at odds. I think also, I mentioned his presidency, where he moved toward using economic coercion as an alternative for war. Hey, it would be better. Too bad it didn't work. If you could just cut off trade rather than send your young men to have themselves killed on battlefields, maybe that would have been for the better world. But in trying to make the embargo work, he stepped on one, particularly New Englanders' civil liberties, to the extent that Leonard Levy has described his second administration as the most repressive in the history of the United States. It was going after one principle, he violated others. Look, the wonderful thing about principles is that they're beautiful and crisp, stated on paper. In life, they have this nasty habit of interfering with each other, so you have to make decisions. That was hard for Jefferson. It's hard for all of us. And maybe that's what's interesting about him, but it's what's often forgotten.
Well, to shift focus away from Jefferson onto you personally as an historian, there's been a large historiography on the American Revolution. And I wondered, maybe you could discuss it briefly, but where you would put yourself in this historiography. You're clearly one of the leading historians of the Revolution.
Oh, my. Where do I put myself in this? Well, I was a student of Bernard Bailyn, who, of course, wrote The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, and so got into the literature of the Revolution early on. In some ways, I carry on that tradition, I suppose, although I am less I write less about political ideas or political philosophy. I sort of assume them. I am much more interested, I guess, in politics and institutions. I don't by any means denigrate them. I've written a lot on the ideas of the Revolution in earlier incarnations. I just never thought that the Declaration of Independence was independently significant as a statement of political philosophy. It isn't a text in political theory. It states ideas which were stated in a more satisfactory way in the eyes of contemporaries and other documents like Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights. I find it very difficult to leave the Revolution because the literature is so rich. I'm a kind of a mole. I like reading this stuff. And although I thought after doing the Declaration of Independence book, maybe I would move on. Maybe, I mean, I have always teased out the significance of the Revolution or tried to do that for later generations. I've even written two things that mention the 20th century and so acknowledge its existence. I think, well, maybe I'd go work on the Civil War. And then I was asked, wouldn't I like to write a book on the ratification of the Constitution? And I said yes. you know, there's the next decade of my life, I guess.
I'm sure many people ask you this, but how would you compare your book with Gary Wills' Inventing America?
Mine's more accurate.
Do you have any particular condemnation?
Well, the
this
big,
one?
The big, I mean, the most memorable statement, I guess, argument. Much of Gary Wills's argument, actually, I agree with, and I indeed cite him positively at several points in my book. He's much more interested, again, in the ideological background of the Declaration of Independence, and again, he sees this as a Jeffersonian text. I don't think if you look at the way the document evolves, you can use it as a Jeffersonian text. For one thing, we don't know which ideas the committee told him to change. Indeed, the one about, you know, the bonds that tie people together, which Wills thought was so important in showing Jefferson's attention to Jefferson's affiliation with the Scottish writers. Well, it came at a point in the evolution of the document that could very well be something the committee told him to change. Jefferson never said that this was supposed to reflect new ideas or his ideas alone. It was supposed to be an expression of the American mind. It was a political document which he did not write alone. He wrote it in close conjunction with other members of the drafting committee. The Congress itself changed it. We know clauses even of the grievances came in because other delegates said, I believe, essentially, include our grievance. It's a political document. It's an authenticated statement of the American mind in 1776. It is not a Jeffersonian document exclusively. Moreover, he says this shows that Jefferson was influenced by the Scots, not by Locke. Well, Ronald Hamway, another very fine historian, pointed out that the Scots were influenced by Locke. So I mean, this is a silly argument.
One last personal question. You are clearly a woman, and you're also a very successful historian. And yet you've not, in your writing, dealt with women's history. You focused on political history and even biographies of men. That's actually one of my favorite
yes.
of your books.
Yeah.
You're teaching at MIT, which has got a male flavor, although you tell me
47% women.
Yes, you tell me.
A lot of women now.
I wonder if over the course of your career that you ever encountered any obstacles because of your sex.
You know, I think I went through graduate school just without paying any attention to what obstacles there were. And I was lucky as I went charging forward and could have hit a brick wall. The brick wall parted, and suddenly women were being hired, not only in women's colleges, but in public universities. I began at UMass Boston and then went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison and on to MIT. So I have not taught in traditional women's institutions. I think a generation earlier, all opportunities would have been in women's institutions. I think the world changed, and I know others of my generation in the academy went through in the same way. That saying, where we're told there were troubles, we just ignored them, and we were lucky we got through. I think there are all kinds of other women that have not chosen to go on. My colleagues in science, for example, are very conscious of this. Younger women who look around and say, hey, there are no opportunities for women here, we'll do something else. What we need to do is get those women in the pipelines, not the ones that put on blinders, but those that may conceivably be a little smarter than us, that look at the world before they charge forward, consider their chances of making it. As to the character of my work, I've always considered history not a form of identity politics, but an act of imagination. And so I thought that what I was to do, what the challenge of history and of the humanities in general, is to understand what it is to be someone else. So why can't I understand 18th century men? I also, incidentally, object very much to the notion that this is white man's history, which some people are prepared to say with a sneer. Martin Luther King wasn't going to give this history to white men. He used it. It's my history. It's the history of my Asian American students who had no ancestor in this country when I began graduate school in most cases, and who touch me year after year by the immediacy with which they respond to the literature of the American Revolution. They understand that this is their history now. We're blessed, I think, that our revolution came in the 18th century that stated its principles as universals, which meant it could be claimed by people who were excluded from power and status at the time of the revolution. And I think it served this country very well also as a means of integrating generation after generation of immigrants. Abraham Lincoln understood this. He said that the principles in the Declaration of Independence were important for the Germans, the Irish, the others, important among his constituents. It made them bone of the bone and flesh in the flesh with the founders and their descendants. This tradition is no monopoly possession of the sons and daughters of the American Revolution. It's my history. It's the history of all Americans living today, because we have made it what it is.
Thank you very much.